Welcome to Create Your Bliss with Nika Annan. And today we have the wonderful opportunity of talking to two marvelous people who are doing some really amazing work in the world. Luis Mel Madrona is a physician, associate professor at the University of New England College of Osteopathic Medicine, and executive director of Coyote Institute for Studies of Change and Transformation. The author of several books, including Narrative Medicine and Coyote Medicine, he lives in Orono, Maine. And Barbara Mangai, I hope I pronounced that correctly, is a psychotherapist and education director for the Coyote Institute for Studies of Change and Transformation. She also lives in Orono, Maine. Welcome to Create Your Bliss, and thank you for writing this wonderful book called Remapping Your Mind, The Neuroscience of Self-Transformation Through Story. So tell me about it.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it's a gift.
Oh, that's very kind. Well, I you know, we've been doing this work for some time, and we wanted to write a book about the work that we're doing. But one of the things I've learned from being a physician is whenever you talk to doctors, you have to throw in a little neuroscience. And so we thought, well, let's throw in a little neuroscience, and then I think we got really excited by the neuroscience because it's so validating of what we believed was effective from our experience. And really exciting for me because I've been involved in neuropsychology and psychiatry for many years, and that sort of convergence of the neuroscience and the clinical is really exciting. And before we started, I was mentioning that when I first started my training, there was this promise of biological psychiatry that we could ignore social phenomena, that we didn't even have to interview people. We could, that ultimately we would have a tricorder like on Star Trek, and we would just scan them without even needing to talk to them, and we would see what neurotransmitters were out of whack, and we would just give them a zap and put everything back in order, and all of the social would disappear. And it's turning out to be the opposite of what they wished. You know, what we're learning is that it's the social that creates the brain and lines everything up and maintains the configuration of the brain. You know, that, and that changing the social is actually an easier way to change the brain than trying to monkey with the brain from inside by giving drugs or things like that. So it's kind of exciting to see that whole project got turned inside out, though many of them don't realize it yet, but hopefully they will soon.
Well, we are gifted, burdened with the human condition, and I know throughout many cultures, in many ways, storytelling has been not just culture building, but how we create ourselves, bring who we are into the world, and that we are an interactive organism.
Exactly. And it really, you know, life happens at that interface of us and the world. And so often we find that you know, we always say that we can help you with your self-world interface, and we are plastic. We are plastic people. We have plastic brains. We have plastic bodies, because this is, you know, there's a whole embodied part of this, which is that, you know, our bodies themselves change. You know, the actual structures of your brain can change based on experience. There's, you know, they talk about how the amygdala changes after trauma. We actually, you know, we are very, very floaty. And and being able to work with that floatiness, being able to create a kind interface with the world and a peaceful interface with the world is often difficult. And, you know, a lot of the people that we see, they really, you know, have learned to go into the world as toughly as possible, as demandingly as possible, as forcefully as possible to try to create themselves in the, in that space, you know, to take the shape that they need to take in that space. They've really kind of got their elbows out, and they're, and that's how they create the space around them. And so we do a lot of work on seeing if people can agree that it might be better to create that that space in a softer way, and to create a softer space around them, and to find a way to work with the world. And so that's a big piece of kind of the creativity of creating space for yourself in the world, but in a way that the world will be receptive to.
Mm-hmm. And I think one of the interesting things about how we operate in the world is, you know, the reticular activating system, which is, and I think to put that into a piece, you know, the story that we're looking to justify is what we find the details that fit into.
Right. That, and you know what's interesting is that we've also come up with we've found some studies that when, you know, that when people come up against information that doesn't fit the story that they're holding on to, mm-hmm. that it activates this sort of fight-flight part of their brain, that they just have to, you know, run away from that information or fight the other person really hard, you know. And you can, of course, see that in the political campaign of that's going on right now in the United States, that there's not a lot of thoughtful discussion going on.
No.
Yes. So I think there's, unfortunately, what we see is a lot of people with entrenched stories who have no interest in dialogue.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like the amygdala would then be a part of that. Do you know that that we amplify our fear sometimes in the story? And I don't know. Can we talk a little bit about why that is, like why we would have those stories, or why we would want to hold on to?
I think stories. You know, we work from the theory that we make stories to create to make the world make sense to us. Mm-hmm. We have stories of how the world works, and they make us feel safe. And a good story about how the world works helps us to stay safe. So if you look at that, then people create stories, and sometimes the story of what makes them feel safe can get a little funny. And maybe it's because part of it was invented when they were really young, or maybe, it, you know, young and experiencing trauma. But people create these stories, and so it's harder to change a story than it looks, because many stories are our safety nets. There are ways that we understand the world, and they were built in a complicated way. Mm-hmm. We didn't just, you know, pop them into place. We developed them over time and based on experience, and maybe based on some not great experiences, maybe based on some not great examples, maybe based on some better examples, but we created them like building a little wall for ourselves of safety. So when people sort of want somebody to change real quick, you have to get deeper than that, because you have to be able to kind of respect how the story came to be, respect its origins and the creation of it, because that's powerful, how it came in to be, the story. Is very powerful, and you can't underestimate the power of that, and especially when it's someone's safety story, when it's something that have helped people feel like they know where they are. And I think, you know, often when, you know, we look at when you have a story, a safe story, and then something comes along to interrupt that story, and suddenly your story doesn't explain the world anymore. It doesn't explain what just happened. You don't have a story about this just happening. So now you need to try to create a new story, and it's very, very disorienting. And you must know, well, you see from your own experience,
right.
It's very traumatizing for people when their story suddenly falls apart. And that journey to recreate the story is kind of the human journey. It's the journey back to safety. How do I make this make sense? How do I create a story which fits this new thing in a way that can bring me any kind of peace? maybe it won't be total peace, but maybe it'll be enough peace. You know, how do I do that? And that requires really honoring the story that went before. And often, you know, we, when our story falls apart, we get mad at ourselves for having a dumb story to begin with. We start being very critical. And, you know, none of that's necessary because stories, we have to be affectionate and gentle with the stories we create because they came in a good way. They came to help us. They came to protect us and make us feel safe. And if they're not serving us now, that's okay. It just means we need a new story. We need to retire that story and bring in a new edition, an updated second edition of the story. And if we could be gentle with ourselves at those moments, if we could, you know, understand that, that we're just letting go of an old story and it's been a good story and it's not, you know, we didn't create it to harm other people. We created it to make ourselves feel safe. And, you know, some people have extraordinary ways of making them feel safe that don't work that well at the self-world interface. So then their stories, they're being told they have to change their story. And then they're, you know, we need to do that, for help them do that, not do it for them, but help them to find a way to find a new story and to feel safe enough to leave their old story. You see that with all kinds of people with, you know, who have very extravagant and detailed ways of feeling safe in the world that, that don't help them get along in the world that well.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we could wind our way back to the amygdala, mm-hmm. and talk about how, you know, the amygdala is that part of the brain that helps us to react to fearful situations, to danger. And, you know, that's useful. It's helpful to our survival to be able to quickly, you know, jump off the path. If there's a snake, you know, a rattlesnake sunning itself at your next step, you know, it's helpful to anticipate danger. But you know, if we don't modulate our amygdala with the stories that we carry, then we're in a constant state of anxiety and panic. We're in, you know, you probably know people who seem to be in fight, flight, or freeze all the time. And it's exhausting to be around them. And it's exhausting to be them. So we need a story, you know, which our frontal cortex helps to create. It says, you know, the world isn't actually all that dangerous as you think. You know, I saw a guy today who got hit by lightning 20 years ago. And he's been terrorized by thunderstorms ever since. And he's got a story that says it's going to happen again. And I asked him, I said, so what are the odds of a guy being hit twice in the same lifetime by lightning? And he said, I don't know, but after I got hit by lightning, I bought a lottery ticket.
So, right.
Yeah, so even he, you know, on some level, he knows that he's dealing, his story is about something that's so improbable as to be almost negligible, and yet it's ruling his life, you know, because he's got a story, you know, it's one trial learning, sort of fear conditioning. Mm-hmm. He's got a story that says it happened once, it's going to happen again. And, well, that could be useful for survival, but in this case, it's not, because he, you know, puts on a blindfold whenever it rains and hides under the bed, and that keeps him from working and having a good life. So, you know, we have to figure out a new story for him to tell his amygdala so that it can stand down, you know, because if you don't control your amygdala, it's going to run away with you.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a couple interesting studies I think you'll enjoy, is that Buddhist monks have shrink their amygdala, and conservative, political conservatives enlarge their amygdala.
What an interesting experimental choice, though. Like what makes somebody feel that one way is safer to the other way. Anyway, go ahead, because you were saying there's other studies, but that's fascinating.
Well, you know, and it could lead you to think that people who are politically conservative are more afraid.
Mm-hmm.
They have more fear. they think the world is more dangerous than people who are politically liberal. It's an interesting study. And so monks who meditate on compassion have smaller amygdalar cortexes. Their amygdala gets activated much less. This was Buddhist mm-hmm. monks. Hopefully Christian monks can do this
as well. Yes.
Hopefully any monk, you mm-hmm. know, who meditates on compassion will shrink their amygdala. And actually it's a particular, you know, part of the amygdala that we're talking about, not the whole thing, but because the amygdala does some other things besides fight and flight, even though that's one of its really important functions. But we have to, you know, I think the problem with having such a lovely brain that we have is that we have to learn to control it. If we don't use our frontal cortex, it's like a dog that just can't resist the squirrel or the porcupine. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't have any sense of the larger whole, you know, and how what we're doing might not be such a great idea tomorrow.
Right.
So people who binge drink seem to have amygdalar problems too. It may be that people drink a lot because they're anxious, which is something we've seen clinically, mm-hmm. you know, because it calms you down. And it may be that their amygdalas are overactive and they have to learn to, you know, to stand down, you know. And the way we do that is we tell ourselves a story. You know, Barbara, you should tell the story of your nephew Tim and how he psyched himself into riding a beat-up, worn-out, broken-down bicycle from our house in Maine to Ontario.
Wow.
Well, yeah, that was an interesting example of exactly what we talk about, because he came to stay with us, and he was thinking of taking this bike ride, and he brought the bike with him, and the family came down to check out our new house and meet our new dog. And so he was getting the bike ready, and the derailleur was messed up. It's a antique 10-speed of his dad's, and he was determined to do it. And he had a lot of stories coming at him. He had a lot of stories about how he wasn't going to make it. He was going to get eaten by bears. He was going to get in trouble on the road. The hills were too high. The bike was too old. He didn't have the energy. All these things. And so you could see him as he went along, but he actually had a conversation with Lewis where they talked about story, and he allowed us how he liked to have good stories to tell. He likes to be able to tell, especially women, good stories. And so he was working on the story ahead of time, and he was sort of experimenting during conversations during the day, because he stuck around for a few days to help us out with some stuff, and he would sort of run stories by us, and we would kind of respond to him and be a good audience by shaping them, and really what he was doing was he was shaping them, and this is a kind of what happens with people who are resilient, and this is sort of an interesting model. But he was shaping the story so that no matter what happened on the trip, he could tell a good story. So no matter if the bike broke down or if he got scared mm-hmm. of bears or whatever happened, he had a good story to tell at the end, whether he made it or not. And he was able to come up with something good to tell people. And it was a really interesting act of persuasion, and he made it. I mean, he created the positive outcome for himself, and then he achieved it. He was able to put himself into the slipstream and act out the story in a way that worked out for him. He got to Ottawa, he pleased everybody, he showed up on his grandmother's doorstep looking a little skinny. But you know, it was a really wonderful experience for him. So, I think, is that what you were thinking of, Lewis?
It was, and the really interesting thing to watch was to see him telling himself a progressively more positive story as the days went on. You know, as he worked on his bicycle and he fixed different parts of it and he got different parts in the mail and, you know, he is an engineering student, so he knows how to fix things.
He did a wonderful MacGyver where he fixed the derailleur by melting on some duct tape. I have no idea what he did, but he literally melted duct tape onto the derailleur.
But by the end, by the day on which his journey commenced, he had a very positive story to work from. That by God, he was going to do this, and he was going to make it, and it was all going to turn out well. And you know, that's what we have to do with each other and for each other, is that we have to create these kinds of stories about life, you know, about the lives that we live, that things are going to turn out well, that we're going to persevere and overcome obstacles and slay the dragon and, you know, rescue the princess and put her back if she doesn't want to be rescued and, you know, just keep on keeping on and it's going to turn out okay. I think for many of the clients that we see, they have, their story is things are bad, they're only going to get worse, nothing I can do will change anything. It's hopeless.
And that's where I see creativity coming in. I mean, I think that you know, and I've said this before, that we don't have any faculties that get given to us for no reason except fun. And I think that the ability to imagine a better outcome and the ability to use that imagination in a good way is something that's really important. I think that's we have this tremendous faculty in imagination and creating our own future that we don't get taught really to use. We get taught that it's a little superfluous, maybe a little silly, and it should be only brought out, you know, in the evenings or on weekends or at a movie or, you know, if you're making a picture. But we don't get taught, look, you can use this in life by imagining outcomes and then helping to create them that way. And I think that's a shame, and I think that's something that by working with story and working in the creative ways that we do, what we're really trying to do is get people excited about the idea of creating this future. That's just what Lewis was just saying.
Well, and to have an underlying theme of the story be, I am resourceful, I am resilient, I can figure it out.
Exactly. Empowerment. Making people, and when that happens, when people hear, one of the exercises that we do is the hero story exercise, where somebody can tell us about a mundane day and we'll offer it back to them as a heroic journey. Mm. And we get people to do that in pairs sometimes. And if you offer somebody, the hero story it follows the kind of the shape of a myth. And the hero is the person going on a journey to find a new story. Sometimes it's to make sure that the place is safe from dragons. Sometimes it's to, you know, make sure you're safe from dragons. But you need a story that allows you to change and grow into your new circumstances, this new safe story. So when you're on that journey to pull together that story, you're like a hero in a myth. You're encountering good guys, bad guys, helpers. You might spend a night out in the lone being afraid that nothing will ever change. You know, you go through all these different stages. You lose hope, you get hope again, you know, and you meet a crone, you know, eventually maybe you begin to put the solution together. But the hero story is necessarily an empowerment story because the hero is empowered. Any action the hero takes, including inaction, is a positive in that sense, is proaction by the hero. So even if I curl up under my blankets, if I tell it from my perspective that I had a bad night and I curled up under my blankets and felt despair, I'm still the one, you know, kind of feeling despair. I'm not turning it into I was made to feel despairing or the world was oppressing me. I'm turning it into I felt despairing. And then the next day I felt better after a good night's sleep or something like that. So you can build little resiliencies into moments of suffering with stories. You can build in little stories of overcoming to an individual moment of suffering. And that's where the story structure is very, very helpful. Because it turns out that it's a lot like the process of human adaptation, and that's one of the great theories that we like by Jordan Peterson, is that the human story of adaptation is that the stories are a metaphor for human adaptation. So this safe story that falls apart and is reconstructed is adaptation, mm-hmm. and we do it by going on a journey.
Yeah, that's very beautiful, and it. I think that's such a useful skill to have. I can remember when I was spending time with a lot of children, and we were going mountain hiking in the mountains and rock climbing, and there was one little girl who kept saying, "I can't do this, I can't do this," and I just said to her, "I said, what if you say I think I can? I'm going to try."
Isn't that famous book, Thomas the the steam engine or something like that.
Mm-hmm. I think I can. I think I can.
Yeah. That's a bestseller for sure. And it's such a good story about perseverance that putting your mind to a task and having agency, as Barbara talked about. You know, that sense that what I do matters has an impact on my world is incredibly correlated with mental health.
Uh-huh.
And we get told often that we don't matter, that our efforts don't matter. And it's not just a negative story that leads us to a kind of existential despair, but it's actually a story that emphasizes a very poor way of maintaining a feeling of good mental health. And it comes out of people's experiences. There's no fault here. It's not, you know, what is it? Everyone is guilty. No one is to blame. You know, people do the best they can. They have life experiences that teach them things or, you know, histories that teach them things that they don't question that much. And they weren't taught to do that. You know, it goes on for generations where people are not necessarily taught to question the stories that have been offered to them and the storytellers who were telling them. They're taught to go along with those stories. They're taught to obey and to honor and to carry those same stories forward. You know, there's stories of a lot of research gets done into, you know, how people vote like their parents, the ways in which we're like our parents. And you know, with parts of ourselves that can go unexamined for a long time, we idolize our parents. We do things the way our parents did for years without feeling like they need to be tested. And, you know, including the good things, which probably don't need to be tested because they're kind of cute. And then the things that if you were really taking a step back, you could go, wow, that story that Dad told about that might not be that helpful for me right now, right here in this world. You know, it might have been fine for him in his world, but it might not be helping me in my world. And, you know, being able to bring that into focus and say, and still say, you know, I love my dad, but I'm just not going to go along with this one story. I'm going to shift to another story because his story was for his time and his life, and I need a different story for my time and my life. And having that flexibility to be able to say, you know, we have a way to let go of, you know, to hold on to the fact that we like the banjo because our dad played the banjo, but to let go of the, you know, his road rage, way he treat, you know, how he thinks about other drivers and whether they should be on the road, you know, and be a little choosy in that. And that's something that, you know, is often new to people, this idea that it's really useful to feel like you can pick and choose and understand that, you know, these are stories and they're both, you know, we would never say something was just a story. We would say it's a story and it's powerful, but nevertheless, it can be changed. you need not live all the stories. Sometimes we use the analogy from film that a lot of people put us in their movies. You know, we're our dad tells us what part to play in the movie, gives us a part in the movie. Our mom does. Our siblings do. Our teachers do. The bank does. Everybody's got an idea of, you know, the bus company does. When we get on a bus, there's a way we're supposed to behave. We get shaped in that behavior. You know, every time we tell a story, we get shaped by the listener in how to tell it. So if I go in and I tell my doctor a four-hour story, the look on his face and the fact that he gets up and leaves in the middle will teach me next time to come in and only tell a one-hour story. You know, we get taught how to tell stories and who to tell them to, and we get recruited to be in movies in a certain way. And it takes a different kind of approach to stand back and say, I can turn down that part. I can turn down the part that I'm being offered by a family member, and I can turn it down gracefully and with respect, and I can pick another part, or I can create my own movie.
And I think there's a really, some of the things that you talk about in the book are actually the experiential work that you do with people in terms of experiencing it in a different way, so that we also incorporate our somatic knowledge in retelling the story and learn how to give more range of voice to different emotions, to different body sensations, to different feelings, and that to be at choice about how we respond to what our body tells us.
Well, I think we would say that all of our language, all of our stories are embodied, and that they're performed through a body. Words are physical processes. Telling a story is a physical act. We can expand upon that by dancing a story, or by moving about the room as we speak. You know, people make big gestures as they're talking, and all of these contribute to the emotionality of the story. And so I think that the more that we play with how the story is embodied, the easier it is to change the story or to become aware of the story that's being carried in the body. And I think that some things are carried in the body that are pre-story, you know, things that happen to us before we have language, or people that, you know, experiences that are so extreme that we don't have words for them. Mm-hmm. You know, and we have to find ways to get them into words in order to bind the anxiety, in order to make the experience manageable.
And then to find a way to retell that. I know that in one of those processes, I was working with a belief and going back, and I realized that one of the basic building blocks of that belief or that piece of the story was decisions I had made when I was 3, when I found out my father had cancer.
Mm. We do. We make decisions when we're really too young.
No, yeah. Mm-hmm. It was a very rational decision for a 3-year-old, but I didn't need to live from it the rest of my life.
And I think that's exactly a great example of the kind of story that needs to be respected, because when you were 3, that was an important piece of your world and how you managed the world. And so, you know, we need to be affectionate with our stories and not get cross with ourselves, but love ourselves for making these stories, love ourselves for being in the game at all, you know. For goodness gracious, you look at the way people struggle in the world and they still show up and you go, this is amazing. Here you still are. That's incredible. And, you know, let's see if we can shift it a little more. But, you know, wow, you got up this morning. That's great, you know.
And to acknowledge that, you know, people say, I don't know if I can do this. I said, you know what? You learned how to walk. Do you know how hard that is? If you had to figure out how to walk, you would never even try.
And it took you 2 years, by the way, you know, and we don't think of that because, you know, but yeah, ask someone who's had a stroke. Yeah.
What an amazing process, and the resiliency that, you know, that is innate to us, because children just keep trying. Adults do too, but you know, when, you know, there's that drive and to cherish it.
And I think that's what the Buddha calls the beginner mind. Well, I'm not an expert at Buddhism, but that's what it's always meant to me when people say we need to be aware and keep our beginner mind open. And that's a little bit of what the Buddha was thinking is that you need to remember that we can be at the beginning of a journey and not know, and that's okay. And it might get a little scary, but we'll be all right. You might want a dog.
Right. How do you support yourself? What is the way that you build around that? And that brings me to a question I wanted to ask, which is about the role of story and ceremony in human resiliency. You know, in so many indigenous cultures, and I guess in Western culture right now, where we do it is, as far as I can tell, like in sports events, but there are cultures that have strong, especially ceremonies that you dance and sing, or that they involve the body physically, that create a story that I think is very a very deep resource for people who have that.
Well, I think it's very comforting, you know, to have these stories that we can enact together. Gives us a sense of group cohesiveness. It gives us a sense of oneness, of belonging, of being part of something, of having some sense of friendliness with the universe, that the universe is not entirely neutral. That maybe as I do these things, I'm thinking of ceremonies, particularly like the dance of the deer among the Yaqui, or the sun dance among the Lakota, or you know, the ghost dance. I'm thinking of ceremonies that give us a sense that the universe is actually listening to us.
Communication between worlds.
Right. And that's a really positive thing, you know, whether it's Catholic Mass or Lakota Sundance, you know, to have a sense that you do matter to the powers is really good. You know, it gives us some sense of predictability, you know, that it's not all going to be bad. That maybe something good could happen. And that's a good story to have, you know. I think the American cultural story is, there are some American cultural stories that we forget because they're so embedded in our awareness. And the Jimmy Stewart movie, It's a Good Life.
Yes.
They play that every Christmas. And also at Christmas is when we get to revisit our cultural stories, like the movie about the boy who gets a wagon, and his father gets a woman's leg as a lamp. It's a famous movie. I can't think of the name of it right now. Maybe it's something Flyer.
Radio Flyer?
Radio Flyer.
Okay.
It's Radio Flyer. It's the one about the kid who keeps getting told he'll get hurt or something, or he wants a BB gun anyway.
He wants a BB gun. And so these stories are just, they're so important.
the embodied stories, the story of, I think, you know, all sorts of things happen too when we dance together. When we dance together, our body rhythms line up and our hearts line up. We enter into each other's energy fields you know, I used to do be part of a group, and we would do exercises like we would have one person dancing around the room in a step and kind of picking up other people as they went by. Mm-hmm. And you learn to just kind of open your energy and jump in, and you would suddenly find yourself doing moves that you didn't really know, but you would be picking them up way more quickly than if you really scrutinized what somebody was doing and went, okay, left arm up, right arm down. So that it was a form of kind of, there's an energetic component to dancing that picks you up. And I think that we do that. I think we share stories through our bodies. There's a wonderful, I mean, we not only have mirror neurons, which are visual, but we also know now that there's, they call it speaker-listener neural coupling, and it means that when you tell me your story, my brain lights up in the same areas, so we share the experience of the story. And that must also, you know, have an effect with music stories, because music is shaped like a narrative. There's a lot of writing about the inherent narrative to music. So mm-hmm. you know, if you think about those things, then our bodies are picking up these narratives. And when we dance, we're sharing the same experience. And you see, one of my favorite examples is always to think about freeway driving, that if we didn't have this other level of understanding each other, we could not drive on freeways. If you're trying to process everything kind of verbally up front all the time, there'd just be endless car crashes. But mm-hmm. it's almost like it's an energy level of connection. And I think that that's part of the experience. So just that I think that what ceremony does is not only bring us into this connectedness, and usually in ceremony there is a carefully prepared energy that is taking place. So you're not, it's not just kind of random. So we're not syncing up with people who are, you know, in a grumpy bad mood. We're syncing up with people who are in a space of reaching out across worlds, who are reaching into the divine, who are opening themselves up in a specific energy flow. So we pick up that energy from each other. And that creates that space of ceremony, which is such a beautiful space to drop in. I mean, that flow that happens when you're in ceremony or around a ceremony. And some of the ceremonies that I've been fortunate enough to attend with Lewis are days long, you know, and you drop into this space where everything is done in a special way to prepare the energy around you. You know, people walk in a clockwise direction, they smudge, they do all these things to kind of create this space to be in. So that as long as we're all holding, creating, co-creating the space with our energy, we're doing it in the best way possible. And that's an amazing feeling. And I think that having, and I think we have to also mention, you know, that the divine or transpersonal or whatever you want to call it, that having that feeling that you're reaching out to connect to something, to the spirit world, to the world of energies around you, provides you with a lot of support and help. And there's a story that I've heard, the story that we are all beings who come, spirit beings who come to Earth to walk in a human body and report mm-hmm. to Creator what it's like. And I think that story in and of itself is a wonderful transformational story, because it's a story that provides a lot of meaning to life experience that can be really challenging, and that allows you a map to go through it. You know, if I experience myself as a spirit being who's walking on the earth, and I find it kind of overwhelming sometimes, and I call out to the other spirits to help me, I go, geez, I don't know what I was thinking when I came down to earth to walk in this life. I sure didn't know what it was all about, and I'm struggling here, and I need a little help. And that gives you a dimension to reach into that isn't accessible to everybody. And I think it's a dimension that offers a profound sense of hope for and resilience.
I think that's true, and I think that that's so helpful. You know, that we, I mean, I find it very interesting, the whole victimology approach to life. And I have, at times in my life, have gotten into heated discussions with friends when I'm trying to tell a hero story about my life and they want it to fit into a victim story.
And we would say, so we look at all the storytellers. So in, you know, in their experience, we look at people's intrapsychic network of storytellers.
Mm-hmm.
So we look at all the storytellers that reside in us. And one of our greatest examples for that is that we knew a woman who was getting in some trouble with road rage. And she needed to figure it out because the police were becoming to pay attention to her, and that wasn't going over that well. And so we determined that one of the characters that was developed in her, one of the storytellers, is the Red Queen. Mm-hmm. And the Red Queen really only knows how to say "off with her head."
Mm-hmm.
That's the only line that she knows. And that the Red Queen somehow had gotten in the habit of driving the car in rush hour. And that it was, we really needed to recruit somebody else to drive the car in rush hour. And whenever we noticed the Red Queen coming, to be able to say, "Look, I understand that you have a grievance and there's someone's head you want to cut off, but we need to do that when it's appropriate. So I'm going to drive the car and you can sit in the back seat. And when we get safely home, then I'll listen to you." And it works in a way of untangling
mm-hmm.
complicated structures that might be going on with us. It's a very user-friendly way of untangling your intrapsychic complexities, and it's also kind of fun. And I think that, you know, we had actually a workshop last weekend, and one of the people in the workshop really was able to discover a whole lot of people. She's had a lot of suffering, and she was able to say, you know, I have a hero persona. I have a jump in there and do something rescuer persona. I have a mothering persona, and I have a victim persona.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's which one is telling the story. So if somebody's listening to your story and they're, I would imagine that they have a victim persona inside them who wants a story that makes them feel good.
Mm-hmm.
And a good victim story helps a good victim. You know, it's a much better story. Whereas a hero story invites the hero to appear, and that your friend might not have really investigated their inner hero as much as their inner victim. And,
uh-huh.
and you know, as I say, there's no guilt there. There's just, maybe they don't know that they have an inner hero. Maybe they've never really thought about themselves that way. Maybe they, you know, they have trouble. A lot of people have trouble recognizing the hero in themselves, or recognizing the good person in themselves, even forgiving, you know, the person who was awkward and struggling. They have a real hard time.
Yeah.
We have a real sense that we were supposed to be doing it right all the time, and I think we need to lose that one fast.
Yeah, and I think, too, one of the things that I run into sometimes, including in my own inner storytellers, is that the polarity, and that there doesn't always have to be a good guy and a bad guy, that it can really be about the journey to learn and to understand, and that sometimes really difficult situations in one's life are nobody's fault.
I think that's a beautiful way to put it. And there doesn't have to be a good guy and a bad guy. There are interactions that don't work that well, that aren't that useful. There are, people who I have people in me who aren't the ones who can go to a party.
Yes.
Yeah. I have, you know, one of my intrapsychic characters really likes to hole up with a good book and should never go to a party. When I was younger, she sometimes wanted to go to the party, but she would always bring a book and sit in the corner. And it was like, no, this isn't working. Like, you
mm-hmm.
really need someone else here. So I think there's, you know, there's fitting where how do we fit who into the world around us to create a peaceful intersection. Now, some people don't want a peaceful intersection. Some people have warriors who need satisfaction.
Right.
And there are times to be warriors. There are times when we need to shout and yell and bring out our swords. But, you know, you get farther, I think, when you use that warrior skill at the appropriate time. And I don't mean when the dominant culture tells you to. I mean when you constructed a good fighting area. Mm-hmm. In a good way, you know, we need to insist on change at times. But there's ways and ways to do that that are more or less useful. And I think that's the thing that we all struggle with is, you know, for example, if I'm in an office trying to get my Social Security check, screaming at the guy behind the desk is not going to create change.
No.
That isn't going to be the thing that's going to get things done. You know, and that's also problematic. But working with the realities allows you to be more strategic. Working with the kind of way the world is allows you to be more strategic about how you try to have an effect on it. And in life, in general, creating a future where positive outcomes are possible tends to lead us towards those positive outcomes.
And I think it's really important, and I think it's important for high-functioning people, and I think it's very important, and I really am fascinated that you work with people who are not, I'm not quite sure if that's the right phrase, but not so high-functioning or who have really debilitating trauma or lack of mental health, and how healing, changing their story can be for them is really inspiring.
It is inspiring, and we, you know, Lewis always says that, you know, as a therapist, you never take credit for what happens because you're the thousandth snowflake that's, you know, the avalanche is mm-hmm. coming because of all the snowflakes. And so it's important to, you know, to remember that and to step back and just do what you do. And if somebody, because it's also vital to recognize that people can only change themselves. You know, we want to create a safe space for somebody to feel like they've been seen and heard, and that if they want to shift their story will be treated respectfully, and maybe we can come up with a different story. And I think when you've been shut down, you know, stopped in all your ambitions and not listened to at all, you know, a whole lot of layers of frustration get added onto that. And, you know, there's a lot of different stories about mental illness at this point. Like Lewis was saying, it hasn't, you know, the whole brain story kind of falls apart. And you look at trauma as a profound, you know, having experienced trauma, especially sexual trauma, and being told to cover it up mm-hmm. and shut up about it is something that seems to, according to the literature, have a really bad effect on a human psyche. And so a lot of kind of disorganized ways of approaching the world come because, you know, the stories that have been put in place to try to work the world are based in a really desperate attempt to try to make sense of what's going on around them in a situation that would be impossible for most people to ever make sense of.
Right.
And so working with that, working with those kinds of stories and acknowledging that place and then kind of trying to come up with a shape of a story that might be helpful is where that work goes. And you know, we don't do it without medication completely. We're not insisting that story will change everything and you should take, you know, everybody mm-hmm. off all medications right away. But we do find that it really seems to help. And there have been profound shifts for some people. And watching people change and get their lives back, that's the jam. I mean, to see somebody looking bright-eyed and feeling confident, oh, my word, that is something else. To see someone just wake up and go, wow, I can do this? Oh, yeah. You know, and it's got to be them. And that's the thing. And when you see somebody take those steps, and leave that kind of leave the, you know, there's a wonderful tradition that I've read about, that the Japanese, there's a tradition of if a pot breaks pottery with a piece of broken pottery, you, when you put it back together, you paint the break with gold. Mm-hmm. And to honor the wisdom that comes from being broken. And I think that that's part of what we're saying to people, is that, you know, let's paint you up with gold. Let's honor what's happened to you and respect it. And then, you know, if there's a chance that we could allow you to have even a few more better days, maybe that would be great. You know, maybe a few more better days could just be a real good thing. Take some of that load off, you know?
Yeah.
And seeing people find that for themselves is profound. And, you know, makes us buck up too. It's like, you know, we're...
Right.
Hey, are we walking our walk? let's get on, you know. It's good.
It's good, and it's fascinating how complex people are and how we and others need different resources, different stories, different, you know.
Yeah. Really individual.
Yeah. And at different times, and how to help people... support them in figuring out what story gives them what it is they're here doing this life, and not assuming we know what that story is either.
Exactly. And that's a really good point. It really means stepping back from all your assumptions, really, really stepping back, really, really listening to their story for the story that it is, and not... Because that's what we do. I mean, there's endless studies of listening and how after 18 seconds we start rushing in with our own ideas of what we think they're saying, and by the way, some helpful advice. And to be able to kind of step back and really hear someone else tell the story their way, and really hear and start listening for how the story got constructed, and not judging. Mm-hmm. Listening without judgment. Listening just, okay, let's figure out how that story came into place. And honoring each of those moments that went into, you know, hammering in the nails of how that story took place. And then, you know, seeing if there's a, you know, it's like characters in our stories need to save face as much as we do. Everyone needs to save face, and that includes the people who you know, have been in our stories. And that guardian model that Lewis was talking about, we talk about how people develop their guardian spirit. You know, they develop... Mm-hmm. Somebody who fights for, who's their fighter spirit. Well, they need to be honored for the warrior that they are. Maybe they also need to be retired, and you need to recruit a new warrior who's, you know, a little calmer. Maybe you don't need that warrior anymore. Maybe that warrior was invented when you were 12, and that's why he's got a funny outfit on, and he shouts a lot, and he jumps up and down with a flaming sword. Maybe now you can find a warrior who's, you know, tech savvy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and can do some other things. But that old soldier needs to be respected and honored and thanked, and not shamed, or, you know, be yelled at, or, you know, they need to be respected and honored and thanked. So it's a model that is respectful in that way of all aspects of people autonomy, even the things that look bonkers to us. It's like little kids, right? Little kids tell you their fantastic plans, and you know, even if they're probably not going to work out, you still support and love that they're telling you that they're figuring it out. And we all do that. That's the truth, is we all do that. We're all much more inclined to have weird little stories about our lives that we live by. You know, one of my favorites is when people are smokers and helping people quit smoking, and asking them who they are when they smoke, what character in a book or a movie or anywhere are you when you smoke? And, you know, you get wonderful answers, you know, and one of my favorite was a very lovely guy who'd been smoking for years, elderly guy, and I asked him who he was. He wanted to quit smoking, kind of. He wasn't really sure he wanted to quit smoking. And I asked him who he was when he smoked, and he said, you know, Johnny Depp. And you know, he gave an insight into first of all, how hard it's going to be for him to quit, because if he quits, he's got to give up Johnny Depp. He's not giving up just tobacco. He's giving up Johnny Depp. Well, and that's really true of all of us and all of our behaviors. You know, who are we when we're doing this behavior? And if you can find that out, then you can find out, you know, some of the power that's in that embodiment, and then a little bit about how to fix it, a little bit about how to suggest that, you know, it's not working that well, and work with it, but not laugh at people, not judge them, not criticize them, just love them, because we are them. We are all bozos on this bus. That's us. We are all silly. We are all beautifully silly in the way we run the world. And, you know, tragedy happens when somebody's way of being in the world is created in a really troubling way. Their stories are really troubling. They've gone unchecked or been, you know, checked in a really complicated way. You know, I'm not saying we can bring peace and heal the whole world. I'm saying that there's people who have, you know, really hardwired, really awful stories. But I think the principle applies into how those stories get created. And I think even behind some of people doing terrible things, you find a lot of suffering.
And that somehow part of perpetuating it is a piece of their story. No, I think it's very true. And I think it's very, the human condition is fascinating and complex. And this is a wonderful tool for helping us understand our own little piece of it and how we participate in it with the rest of the world.
It's all stories.
It's all stories.
We are all stories. All right. I should probably go now too.
Well, I wanted to thank you. Is there any, do you have a website that we can send people to let the listeners go to find? The book is called Remapping Your Mind from Inner Traditions and Coyote Medicine. You do have a website for that, don't you? Do you have the URL?
For Coyote Institute, we have www.coyoteinstitute.us. And we also have a Facebook page, which is Coyote Institute. And you can tell it's us. You can see pictures of people building a structure on the front of it. So, and then our logo is on there, and we try to put anything that we're doing. We always work on a sliding scale. And what we do have that might be interesting for some is we don't have one going at the moment, but we almost always do have one. We'll start one up soon. Is we have a call in for people who are working in this way. Kind of a rounds or a case presentation. If somebody wants to call in as a practitioner or somebody who just thinks it's useful for them to work with story, we have a call where you can call and we can all chat about, you know, what we're doing and what we're trying to do here. So we don't have one going, but when we do, we will post it on the Coyote Institute Facebook page and on the website.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. You learn a lot from hearing how other people are working with this, so yeah.
And creating a ceremonial group to work with story. Thank you so much, Louis Malmadrona, who dropped off to attend to his patients, and Barbara Mangai. I'm very grateful for your conversation today.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.